What do you think about Jesus? What's your decision about him? I ask that because Jesus taught, very simply, that the most important decision a man or a woman could make in life would be their decision about him, about what to do with him. Imagine this. Two men went out to build houses. They gathered their materials. They got their plans together for their homes. They went to work. One man built his house on rock. The other built his house on sand. Outwardly, the houses looked almost the same. That was until the storms came and the rains began to fall and the waters came up against these two homes. One of them stood and the other fell terribly. That's a story that Jesus told. And he told it to illustrate the fact that I've just put before you, that the most important decision a person can make is their decision about him. According to this first century itinerant teacher, if a person hears his words and lets those words go into their heart and change them, they will be like a house built on rock. And on the other hand, if they hear his words and they're dismissive or indifferent, they treat it as if it's a little good advice to take or leave, they'll be like a house built on sand. It's one way or the other. Jesus wanted people to see him so they'd make a decision about him, to make a decision about how to regard him. We've been together each week leading up to Easter, taking our time to look again at Jesus through some of the artwork that was composed by some of the good, really especially great masters of the craft, some Dutch painters in the 16th and 17th century. And we've been using them to help us see Jesus more clearly. This morning, we're going to look at a story that's told at the end of the Gospel of Luke, the story that describes Jesus' death. And we're going to be aided as we look by this piece here, an artist whose name I'm sure you'll all know, Rembrandt. This is a reproduction of a print of his that was made from an etching and a dry point. We're going to look at it together, and for this reason. And I'm going to say this as clearly as I can, and then we'll look at it and the story in Luke. In this scene, we have a moment where a man makes a decision about Jesus. And I want us to look at it for this reason, so that each of us would be put in the position of making our own decision about Jesus. Those of us who've already decided in faith to follow him need again and again to decide about him. Yes? Yes. Those who've never made a decision, we ought to be confronted with this moment of decision. And that's what happens here, and we're going to look at it together. So let's direct our attention at this image up on the screen. I want to zoom in. Actually, first, let me say, in this moment, Rembrandt captures every person who's described in all four Gospels at the end of Jesus' life. We're not going to look at everyone in this moment. If you want, after we're done, out in the hall, there's a reproduction of this. It's a really stunning image. It's stark and it's sharp and cold. It doesn't have any of the softness of color or warmth that the other paintings of Rembrandt and other artists have, very simply because, as you can tell, it's black and white. The artist made this print because he needed money. Imagine that. You know now, most likely, that his work sells. It's impossible to acquire because it's so valuable. This piece is actually in the Met, so you can go see it yourself. He sold his other prints to buy the materials to make this. A piece of metal, some wax, which he spread out on the metal and then scraped with just a very simple wooden carver, and then dipped that metal into acid, and it etched the scene that you see there onto the metal plate. After washing the wax off with a needle, he scraped in the very fine detail lines that you see around here. And it's an etching and dry point that can be used to reproduce prints over and over again. Now, if you go online, as I did, and listen to folks talk about it, look carefully at these three figures, what you will hear mostly from every commentator is a rundown of how this scene here shows us Rembrandt's progression as an artist. After making this first etching, he reprinted it over and over again over 10 years, altering it along the way. And so that's one thing all the commentators will talk about. And the second thing they'll all say is this. This is a scene where we see Jesus and two thieves. On one side, the bad thief. Help me here. On the other side, the good thief. That was pretty noncommittal on your part. I really set that up. That was easy. The bad thief and the good thief. Now, I mention this to say All of the wisdom that the commentators, the artists can bring about what happens here is valuable, but at this point they're all wrong. Because there is no such thing as a good thief. A good thief doesn't end up on a cross. In the New Testament, the man on the right of Jesus and the man on the left of Jesus are both described with exactly the same singular word, criminal. We have, in this moment, three people who are dying. Two of them are bad thieves, bad criminals. One of them, if he is a criminal and he is being condemned as a criminal, is good. We want to make one man bad and one man good for a very specific reason. We love having little boxes to put people in so that we can identify with the good guy and hate the bad guy. So we can make ourselves feel good because we're like that good man and distance ourselves from the bad guy. If we do that in this moment, we miss not only the artistic integrity of what's captured here, which is two criminals and one Jesus, we also miss the sharp theological point, which is as sharp as a needle scratching in metal. And it is this. What differentiates the two men on either side of Jesus is not that one is good and that the other is bad. What differentiates them is the decision that they make about Jesus. One of them makes a certain decision about Jesus, and the other makes a different decision. And that is what sets them apart. Now, this scene, which Rembrandt captures with such power and such gravity, is told to us in the Gospel of Luke. In all four Gospels, we read that there were two criminals that were crucified with Jesus. In only one are we given to overhear their conversation. And in the Gospel of Luke, that's where we hear the conversation that takes place. And both criminals are given voice. And I want you to look with me in chapter 23 of Luke, in verse 39, here's what the first criminal says. I'm going to read that and then talk about it with you. Here's what it says in verse 39. One of the criminals who were hanged there kept deriding him and saying, "Are you not the Messiah? Save yourself and us." The first man to speak up asks a false question of Jesus. Have you ever asked someone a false question? You're not really asking something, you're saying something. You're sharing your opinion, and that's what's happening here. This man is sharing his own assessment of what's happening, and when he says, "Are you not the Messiah?" what he means is, "You are not the Messiah." And he means this for a very definite reason. Jesus and his people, for as far back as anyone could remember, had hoped that one day God would send a deliverer to take them out of oppression and out of their misery, to free them and set them at liberty. Maybe you yourself know in your own life that there are things that hold you captive and you wish for a deliverer. In the history of God's people, that feeling was poignant. From the moment that they were taken from their homeland in Jerusalem into captivity in Babylon, if you're a church person, maybe you've heard about the exile. Have some of you heard about that? As soon as those people were taken away into exile, they began to hope in earnest for a deliverer who would come and set them free. For a powerful figure who would come with God's power to set those captives at liberty and to release the prisoners. The name for this figure that, for which they hoped was Messiah, God's anointed one. Now, when Jesus came on the scene and began to talk early on in his ministry, the first public sermon he gives in the Gospel of Luke, the same gospel that tells this story, the first words, in fact, that he speaks to a crowd like this are when he stands up and he says this, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." Okay, that's a way of saying, "I am anointed by God." That's word Messiah. "And he has sent me to pronounce good news to the captives, to set the prisoners free." First words out of his mouth in a public assembly in the Gospel of Luke. His whole life moving forward arises the hopes in all of those people around him that maybe this rabbi who's teaching us is in fact the Messiah that our people have longed for. Maybe he's the one who will deliver us and set the prisoners free. And that's how his life unfolds up to this moment. But now, as far as this first prisoner can see, this first captive can see, Jesus can't even free himself. Can you blame him for thinking that? He hangs on a cross and looks beside him and sees another man who is bound to the cross with nails. And so he says, in effect, "You are not the Messiah." And then the second thing, he adds, Save yourself and us. He makes a demand of Jesus, which if we are attentive to the Gospel of Luke, we will see is drenched in irony. What I mean is, not only does Jesus appear as the expected Messiah in the Gospel of Luke, but those of you who know the story will know this, the way that the Messiah will save others, which is Jesus' mission, is by refusing to save himself. This first criminal may not know this, but if we've read the Gospel of Luke, we know this strange twist, that the Messiah that the people had hoped for will come and save others by choosing to give his life for them. Have you heard that Jesus died for others? That's a very simple claim, that the way he will be the Messiah is by choosing not to save himself. And so this criminal, when he says, save yourself and save us, can't get what he asks for. And that's the irony. Because if Jesus saves himself, he won't save anybody else. And the only way that Jesus will save others is by choosing not to save himself. What we have here is two things. Listen now, a man who's made a decision about Jesus. And his decision about Jesus is, this guy is a failure. And then secondly, we have a man who cannot see what's really happening in this moment. That's what we know if we've read the Gospel of Luke carefully. Look with me again at Rembrandt's depiction of this scene. This is where there is a detail in his rendering of this moment that is missed by all the commentators that I found. Look with me at the criminal that is on Jesus' left hand. This is the first man who speaks. What is striking about him is that he appears to be bathed in light that is coming from heaven. Do you see that? If you look again out in the hall at the image that we have out there of the entire piece, you'll notice it's very plain. A light as if from heaven comes down and shines right upon him. His face is tilted up toward heaven. These two you would expect to be the conditions by which someone would be able to see God, if they're looking in the right direction and somehow the divine light is shining down upon them. But if you will pay close attention to his face, to the way that Rembrandt captured his face with just a few scratches, do you see that you cannot make out any facial features above his nose? Do you see that? Yes or no?
Yes.
All right, excellent. Thank you. I didn't know. I can't see you. It's dark. That's because he has been drawn or scratched with a cloth or a rag draped over his eyes. Which means even though he looks in the right direction, and even though light from heaven shines down upon him, it does him no good because he is in effect blind. And that means that when he looks at the scene, and when he looks at himself, if he would look at himself, when he looks at others around him, and when he looks at Jesus, his assessment is meaningless because it comes from eyes that are completely blind. His judgment is powerless. That's captured in the posture of this man. You see how he hangs limp. His hands at his back, they're bound there. He has no power, and his judgment captures nothing of the truth. I believe it's the artist's way of saying, this first man with his decision about Jesus is wrong. Now we're going to look in a moment at Luke's description of the second criminal's assessment of Jesus. We're going to hear his words to this first criminal and to Jesus. We're going to hear how Luke captures his decision about Jesus. I want you to know this. I would like you to see his decision about Jesus so you personally would be questioned by God about your decision. But first, before we look at Luke, I want you to look at Rembrandt's capturing of this second criminal. If we pan over onto Jesus' right side, the left side of the image, we see two remarkable differences between the first and the second criminal. First of all, you see that this man's eyes are completely uncovered. He's not altogether in the light because he is a criminal. He's bad. He's tangled up in shadows in this moment, just as he was in his own life. But his eyes are uncovered, which means that unlike the first criminal, he can actually see what's happening in this moment. He can see Jesus, he can see himself, and he can see all those gathered around Jesus. In Rembrandt's etching, this man can see that there are some soldiers who are making a game of the death of the middle man, that they're throwing dice to decide who gets his clothing. This man can see that the religious authorities who had condemned Jesus to death are walking off with their proud victory over a very gentle and kind man whose sentence they have just sealed, whose death has gotten them finally free of his hands. This criminal can see the other religious authorities who sneer and mock. He can see the soldiers who lift a sponge soaked with vinegar, taunting this man in his hour of greatest weakness. Not only that, he can also see with these eyes, which are tangled in shadows, the women off to the side who are weeping in anguish and grief. He can see this man's mother, who is broken because she is witnessing the death of her son at the brutal hands of a public execution that is shameful. Have you ever seen a mother who had to bury her own son? Have you ever been in the presence of someone like that? Maybe someone in here has been in that situation and expressed that anguish and grief. I've seen it with my own eyes. It is terrible. This criminal can see all that. He can also see that in this mixed crowd of grief and shallow victory, there are those who are broken up because this man is someone about whom they've made a decision. He can see the apostles holding their heads. He can even see a Roman centurion on his knees, the one man in this crowd who vocalizes, truly this man was innocent, he was righteous, God's own son. Please take time later on to look at the image as we have it there in the hallway. You'll notice that the gaze of this criminal appears to be, by Rembrandt's design, looking down upon that soldier who kneels in deference to Jesus. That's the first thing that's quite different about him, that his eyes are uncovered, but there's a second thing that Rembrandt has done. Do you notice the difference in his posture? His hands. They're raised up, aren't they? Of course, this is artistic license. The Bible doesn't say what their hands looked like, but Rembrandt wants to suggest that this man, instead of being powerless, has some power, not that comes from him, but from what hits his hand. Do you notice his right hand? The right hand is the hand of fellowship. That's why we still today seal promises with a handshake and our right hands. It's the hand that you extend when you are reaching out to somebody in relationship, when you're seeking to grasp the truth of something and seal a promise. This man's hands, which are raised as if to worship, his right hand has a beam of light that is very obviously shining right down upon it. As if to say, with his decision, he has reached out to heaven and he has grasped a hold of something true, the light. Not because he's good, he's bad, but because of the decision he has made about Jesus. Let's look at the text for a moment in Luke's telling of this story. After this first criminal speaks, the second one says his words. He speaks, first of all, not to Jesus, but to the first criminal. This is how it goes in verse 40. But the other rebuked him. Now, that means he spoke out harshly against the first criminal, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation?" Remember the first criminal? His question was a fake question to Jesus. This criminal's question is a real question to the first criminal. Do you not fear God, since we are under the same sentence of condemnation? He asks this real question because he can see what's happening in the moment. And what's happening in the moment is that both criminals are under the same sentence of condemnation as the man in the middle. And that, for this second criminal, is a frightful thing. Because, as he goes on to say, we indeed have been condemned justly, for we are getting what we deserve. Think of it. This man looks at the situation in which he finds himself, and he knows that he is guilty and that he is being sentenced by an earthly judge, and he is receiving a sentence which is particularly bad. He's being killed. But he knows that that's actually not as bad as the next thing which he believes he will face. In his mind at this moment is this fact, that as bad as this earthly condemnation is for what he's done wrong, it does not compare to what he believes he will face next. And that is, he believes that after this earthly death, it will not be a complete end of his existence, that he will stand before the divine judge, and in that moment will have to be accountable for what he has done in his own life. Have you ever thought about that moment? You know, most people think about that when they're about to die, as this man is. Have you ever had one of those near-death moments where your life flashed before your eyes and you wondered what it would be like to stand before God? Have you? I see many people saying no. Has anyone? I've had some of those. No? I was driving my Alfa Romeo too fast on a snowy night, and I was spinning in circles, and I thought, I'm about to meet God. What's that going to be like? There's a Matt Agresti, who's a member of our staff. He also works in the hospital. He would tell you that many of the people he's with, as they are about to face their own death, they begin to wonder, if it's true, what will it be like if I have to stand before the divine judge? In this moment, that second criminal is thinking about that, and he's afraid. And he wonders why the other criminal isn't also afraid of that, because secondly, he sees himself and this other man and says, look, we are both guilty and we're getting what we deserve. And maybe you have come into this place with a little awareness of your own guilt in life. Have you failed to be the man or the woman that you're pretty sure you should be? I know most of us, if we're honest, would have to say yes. This man in this moment is quite aware of that. And not only does he direct the attention of the first criminal to his own guilt, but he also does a second thing. Did you notice what he says there at the end? But this man has done nothing wrong. Do you see what he's doing? He's asking the criminal to look at the man in the middle, Jesus, and he's pointing out Jesus' innocence. Now, this is also ironic and very powerful. You know, in this story, in this gospel, this is the last man on earth who talks to Jesus before he dies. There's significance in that, the last conversation you get to have before you go. And in this moment, as Jesus is hanging on the cross, please try to imagine this. His own people powerless to stop what's happening and gathered around in misery, believing, just like the first criminal, that he must be a failure. The one person on earth who speaks up on his behalf and comes to his defense is a criminal. Can you imagine that? And this criminal says in front of everybody what's true. This man hasn't done anything wrong. And it raises this question for us, and we should consider it. And I want to do that with you for a moment. What did this man here see in this man here that made him make this decision about Jesus? What had he seen? And that's a question that we can get an answer for fairly easily. This story is in the middle of the Gospel of Luke. If you read from the beginning of that Gospel, chapter 23, you'll hear about the mourning that preceded this event. It starts out with a trial where Jesus is present before Pilate, the Roman authority in that region, and he's been brought there by his own religious cohort, and they've demanded that he be killed. And we can assume that those other criminals were there on that morning as well. And so now, if you would use your imagination for a moment, picture this. You've committed a crime. You're going to be killed that day. You are brought before a large crowd of people, and there's a rabbi beside you in chains also, like you are. And Pilate begins to interview Jesus. And do you know what Pilate says about him? Do you know this? He's innocent. He brings Jesus to Herod, who's the king of the Jews, and says, look, he's your responsibility. I don't see anything wrong with him. Guess what Herod says about him? He's innocent. He delivers him back to Pilate. Pilate says yet again. He asks him some questions about who he is. He says, I'm sorry. I cannot, in good conscience, move this man to death. He's innocent. The crowd says, we want Jesus to be crucified. A third time, Pilate says to all of them, he's done nothing wrong. He's completely innocent. Look, I'll flog him, I'll beat him up and let him go. And they say, no, crucify him. So what this thief has seen this morning is without any question that this man is innocent. And this is very important as well. The entire time that Jesus stands there, being accused falsely by his own people, not once does he fight back. Can you imagine what that would have been like to see that? And now after seeing that, this is what happens next. They leave Pilate's headquarters and they have to walk out of the city of Jerusalem, up to the hill where they're all three of them going to be executed publicly in front of the crowds. And so they begin to walk, and now imagine you are this thief, you know you're guilty, and here you know this man is innocent, and as you start to walk along, there's a second thing that happens on that road. There are some women, and Luke details this clearly, there are some women who start to cry so loudly they actually get Jesus' attention on this road. They're weeping and wailing for him. I've asked you if you've ever seen a mother have to face the death of a child? And some of you maybe have faced that kind of grief. If you've ever seen a group of people expressing unfettered anguish over the loss of someone they cared about, you know how moving it is. You would have been moved too if you were that thief. In this moment where he sees this innocent man and his followers grieving him, he hears Jesus turn to the women and say, "You should not be crying for me. You should be crying for yourselves and your children." Now, if that's not an ominous saying, I don't know what is. What he means to say is, the public execution, which I'm moving toward now, is bad, but what is far worse is the day of the Lord. The judgment that will come for all of the people in this area who are complicit in this perversion of justice and my execution. If you think this is bad, what I'm facing, you don't know bad, because what's really bad is when you'll have to stand before the heavenly judge and make an account for all that you've done. Can you imagine thinking of that now? And imagine especially that you're that thief, that bad criminal, not the good guy, the bad guy, and you've just heard Jesus direct everyone's attention to that fact. I would be afraid if I were him. This is a third thing that happens. They get up to the top of the hill, they lay Jesus down on the cross, they begin to drive the nails into his hands that will hold him there, and then Jesus says a prayer. He addresses God. And he addresses God with the word Abba, which is the familiar term for God, Father. And so this thief hears this man, who's a good man, and everybody knows it, who hasn't done anything wrong and who's being killed, finally open his mouth and start to pray. And instead of just saying God Almighty, he says Father. Abba is actually as familiar as the word Daddy. And surely it must have been brought into his mind at that moment that this man's followers had accused him of claiming to be God's own son. And now he's praying as if God is his own father. What will he say in this moment? What will this man, who's being killed by all these enemies, say to his divine father if God is indeed his father? Please listen now. Those people in those days believed, and I think they're right, that the divine father had such power that he could melt the mountains with a word. What will this wrongly accused man say to his father in this moment? And what comes next, I believe, went right into this criminal's heart. What Jesus says is, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Listen now, what he heard in that moment is the decision that Jesus had made about everyone around him. And when I stood here to tell you that the most important decision that you can make is your decision about Jesus, I was thinking then about what I wanted to say even then, but I'll say now, even more important than your decision about Jesus. In fact, the foundation that makes it possible for you to make a decision about Jesus. In fact, the rock that is underneath the ground upon which you can build your house is the decision that Jesus has made about you, which was expressed in this moment as this good man was being wrongly nailed to the cross when he did not ask for divine retribution against the man holding the hammer, against the people holding him down and nailing him there, against the soldiers who were making sport of his death, against the religious authorities who condemned him for doing nothing wrong at all, against even the two criminals on either side of him, one of whom mocked him. Instead of asking for divine wrath and fury against them, he asked God to be merciful to them. Can you imagine what it would feel like in that moment to be there? Can you? On the basis of that experience, this second criminal, he chastises the first criminal and tells him to be quiet, and then he turns and speaks to Jesus like this. I want you to see his words to Jesus. Verse 42. Then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. In this one sentence, he expresses his decision about Jesus. It is the last sentence that a human being speaks to Jesus before he dies in the Gospel of Luke. The very last words that are shared with this king are the words of a criminal, and he says, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. In that one sentence, we can see the elements of his decision about Jesus. If you would look closely with me, you'll see them too. When he says to Jesus, your kingdom, he is saying to Jesus, I decide in this moment to regard you as the true king. And that means I do not believe that Pilate is the true king. The man who rules with an iron fist and kills those who stand up against him, he is not my king. My king is the one who rules from a cross rather than from a gilded throne. My king wears a crown of thorns rather than one that is gold and filled with jewels. When he says to Jesus, your kingdom, he's saying that I have decided that Herod's not my king. The religious figure that the Jews had put as the king in those days was tyrannical and wicked. He was notorious for his tyranny against those who stood up against him. Jesus was known for being gracious to his enemies, and this man's decision is, that is my king. He's also deciding, by the way, that I am not my own king. And that's one element of his decision. There are two other elements. When he says to Jesus, remember me, what he's asking for is mercy. And imagine this. Remember, he's picturing that after he goes, he will stand again before the divine. And in that moment, he will be judged. And what this man has decided is this. My only hope in that moment is that I don't have to stand and make my own case, but that there'll be someone who stands beside me and pleads my case for me. And he asks Jesus, would you remember me? And that means when we stand there, would you please stand beside me instead of making me stand on my own? And would you put the same word before that judge that I've just heard you put before him as you've prayed? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. In this moment, it means the man has looked back on his life and said, you know, all those times I was wrong and failing and wandering away from God, I just didn't know what I was doing. And right now, my only hope is that Jesus will stand beside me and remember me. There's one other part of his decision, and it's the most tender, the hardest to see. Look at how he addresses Jesus. Do you see it? It's one word, Jesus. And you will miss this unless you read through the Gospel of Luke very carefully. In the entire Gospel of Luke, there is only one time ever where a person addresses Jesus simply by using the word Jesus. And not just in Luke, but in the entire New Testament, no one else ever refers to Jesus just by calling him Jesus. They call him Jesus, Son of God, Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus, Son of David, Jesus, Messiah, Jesus Christ. Never once, except for here, does anyone just call him Jesus, and this address is unique because it's the most familiar address that anyone has ever used. It's the one that is reserved for an intimate friend. Which means this man has not only decided that Jesus will be his king and Jesus is the one that he must ask for mercy from, but that Jesus will receive him as a dear friend, the closest friend. Isn't that amazing? The last person to talk to Jesus in the Gospel of Luke is the one who treats him with the most intimacy as a friend, and it's a criminal. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. This is his decision about Jesus. And the question that it puts before you, which I would like you to consider in this moment, is what do you decide about Jesus? Those of you who've decided long ago to follow this man, and those of you who have not yet decided, what is the decision that you make about him? Listen, please, not what is the decision that you make about every theological question that anybody could have. That's not what this decision is about. That can come later. Not what decision do you make about this brand of church, this denomination, this preacher, this style of worship. Set all that stuff aside. That's not what this is about. It's about Jesus. Not what decision do you make about which political party to align yourself with, or what kind of people do I want to be associated with? I've heard there are Christians and I don't want to be associated with them. Look, set all that aside. This is a question about your decision about that man, Jesus, who hangs on the center cross. What do you decide? Someone will say, I have lots of questions still. That's fine. You can still make a decision about him. Someone will say, I am too bad. You are not worse than either one of those criminals. Someone will say, to be frank, I'm too good. And seriously, I don't need him. He's got some good advice, but I don't need someone to stand before me. I'm okay. And all I can say to you is I will not try to convince you that you're not okay. That's no fun, and I wouldn't be able to do it anyway. You should ask God to give you a clear light so that you can see in your own self where you stand before him. Listen now, the decision that you make about Jesus will be the most important decision for you in death. And I deeply believe that I know, I'm sure of this, you're all going to die. That sounds bleak, right? You're all going to die. at some point. And in that moment, the decision you make, it's not whether you're a good criminal or a bad criminal. That's nonsense. It's what decision have you made about Jesus? Will you look to him and say, you are going to be my king, and you're the one I'm going to ask for mercy from, and I believe you'll receive me as a friend. But it's not just for death. Someone will say, fine, I'll wait until I'm about to be crucified. I'll make the decision at the very end. That's when I'll make a choice about Jesus. Listen, death might visit you tonight. And it's not just in death that this decision makes all the difference. It's in life as well. In every moment of life, the decision that you make about Jesus will change your experience of the very next moment and the one after that and so on. You'll fall back into your old ways, but you'll need to decide again about him. But the way you decide about him will change absolutely everything. Do you know this? Some of you know this very well. Look at how Jesus responds to this man's decision. And this is how he will respond to everyone who decides, as this man does, to regard him as king and ask for mercy and to seek a friend in him. Verse 43, he replied, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." Paradise is an ancient Persian word that means park or a lovely garden, a place of peace and serenity. It is the opposite of where these men are on that hill. It's exactly the opposite. And Jesus, when he replies to this man that I tell you, today, he doesn't just say you will be in paradise. Do you notice what he said? You'll be with me. And that means what Jesus is saying to this criminal, the last person that he speaks to, is I want you to be with me. I want you. And this is the decision that Jesus has made about all of us. He wants us. Every one of us. With our doubts, with our fears, with our anxieties, with our failures and our successes, with the things that we're really bad at, and with the things that we're skilled at as well. Every bit of us, he wants us. And if you simply decide for him, he has already decided for you, and this promise is your promise as well. And so the question again is, what decision do you make about that man there on the cross? I said that the decision you make will make all the difference in life and or death. I want to close with one historical example of this truth in a person who decided for Jesus, for whom it made all the difference in life and in death. Some of you have heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, perhaps. Others who have not, you ought to look into this person. He was a German. He was born in Germany. He grew up and was a brilliant young man, became a student of theology and excelled, was a total genius. And he was around at the time of the Second World War. He was there when Hitler rose to power. He was there when the German Christian church, God forbid it, this is so scandalous, stood with Hitler against the Jews and sought to justify the enslavement of Jewish people by twisting Jesus' words. Can you imagine? That's what was happening in his country. This young man, Bonhoeffer, went off to New York City because he was so talented. He actually taught in New York City. And when Hitler rose to power and many of the Christians who believed it was wrong were fleeing Germany, he decided to go back to Germany to stand up against Hitler. It landed him in prison. He was imprisoned for it, for his refusal to stand by and watch. Why? Because he followed Jesus, because he believed in Jesus, and it made a difference in his life. He ended up first in a military prison and then in Flossenbürg. Have you heard of that place? One of those despicable concentration camps. He was imprisoned with men from all over the world. Russia, there were Germans with him. There were people from England who were there with him and France. There were many people with different faiths. In that prison, he became a pastor to all of the prisoners who were there because that's who he was. He started to speak to them day after day and pray with them day after day. There was one English officer that upon whom this man made a very deep impression. And listen to what he wrote. This is after Bonhoeffer was killed, just a few days before the camp was liberated. Can you imagine that? He was murdered for his faith just a few days before, and there were thousands like him, millions who were killed. This is what the English officer wrote about him. "Bonhoeffer always seemed to me to spread an atmosphere of happiness and joy over the least incident and profound gratitude for the mere fact that he was alive." Have you met someone like that? You know why he was so grateful and joyful? It's because of the decision he made about Jesus, even in a concentration camp. The officer goes on to write, "He was one of the very few persons I've ever met for whom God was real and always near." And then he goes on to write about the last day of Bonhoeffer's life. Now listen, the difference that his decision about Jesus made in his life is that he was a man who was joyful and happy and grateful just for being alive, whether he was teaching at a prestigious chair in New York City or locked up in a prison about to face death. It made a difference in his life, and your decision about Jesus can make a difference in your life, but then also in death. Listen to this last sentence he wrote. On Sunday, April 8th, 1945, Pastor Bonhoeffer conducted a little service of worship and spoke to us in a way that went right to the heart of all of us. He found just the right words to express the spirit of our imprisonment, the thoughts and the resolutions it had brought us. He had hardly ended his last prayer when the door opened and two civilians entered. They said, "Prisoner Bonhoeffer, come with us." That only had one meaning for all of us: the gallows. We said goodbye. He took me aside. He took this one man aside. To me, he said, "This is the end. But for me, it is the beginning of life." The next day, he was hanged in Flossenbürg. The text on which he spoke to us that morning was, "By his stripes we are healed." Those are the words of the prophet Isaiah from chapter 53, where Isaiah says, quite simply, the servant of God will save others by choosing not to save himself. In other words, the decision that has been in the heart of God since the beginning is to come to this desperate and lost creation of his, not with wrath but with mercy, to take the place of the prisoner and to give himself so he will save others. That is the decision that has been made about you, and the question is, what is the decision that you will make about Jesus? Let's pray together. God, we thank you for artists who use metal and acid, needles and ink and paper. We thank you for Luke, who took such great care to record the events of the life of Christ. We thank you that when we pause and take a close look, that we can see who Jesus is, especially the decision that he's made about us. I ask very simply that each one of us would be moved to make our own decision about Jesus, not about all the other things that we think come along with it, but very simply how we will regard this one Jesus as we see ourselves truly. I thank you that it is with mercy that you receive every person who chooses for you. I thank you that you are willing to regard even the worst of us as your friends. And I thank you that you do choose to remember us. And I thank you that you are the true King. God, for the people that you've gathered into this place this morning, I offer a special prayer of thanks. I thank you that I have the great privilege of speaking of you in the presence of my family and of my friends, and also of strangers who are new to me. You have created each one of us and this moment for something good. I pray that your goodness would have its way with everyone gathered here in this moment. I ask in Jesus' name. Amen.